Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kit Gage, coordinator of the National Coalition to Protect Political Freedom, who condemns a Bush administration executive order authorizing military tribunals to try non-citizens charged with terrorism, Ritu Sharma, executive director of Women's Edge, who talks about congressional legislation urging the Bush administration to make the restoration of women's rights in Afghanistan a priority, and author and activist Starhawk, who reports from Ottawa on the state of the global social justice movement as demonstrations greeted delegates of the World Bank and IMF as they met in the Canadian capital November 17th and 18th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
26-year-old Palestinian Mohammed Sirtawi, a college-educated native of Nablus, is set to flee the West Bank. He's worried about losing his job at a wireless phone company and the fact that nobody is able to make much money in Palestinian-controlled towns. Now, a year after the start of the Second Palestinian Intifada, Sirtawi says it is time to pack and move to Canada to stay with a relative who works in the computer industry. According to the World Press Review magazine, there has been an exodus of young, educated Palestinians in recent months. They are leaving for Europe, the United States, Canada, and Australia. Some of those fleeing work for the Palestinian Authority, or major non-governmental groups serving people in the territories. A Palestinian woman who works with an NGO says, "We simply cannot go on living like this." 29-year-old Yusuf Barakat used to make good money as a dealer in a Palestinian casino in Jericho. But since the uprising began, the casino has closed. Fluent in French, Barakat is heading for a brighter future in Paris. But the majority of poor Palestinians have nowhere to go. Israeli restrictions on travel are the cause of most of the economic dislocation, and amidst continuing violence, there are sadly no political solutions in sight. The news magazine In These Times reports that the next front against global terrorism could be in the jungles of Southeast Asia. Asian intelligence chiefs are particularly worried about Abu Sayyaf, a militant Islamic army based in the islands of the southern Philippines that has taken responsibility for kidnapping over 70 foreign tourists in the last 6 months. Four tourists have been executed. In recent months, Asian intelligence agencies have gathered evidence linking Abu Sayyaf with the Al-Qaeda terrorist network, including direct funding from terror mastermind Osama bin Laden. And since the September 11th terror attacks in the United States, the Philippine government has opened up two military bases to American troops. In October, the American military presence in the southern Philippines increased significantly when advisors arrived to instruct the Philippine army in tactics to fight the Islamic rebels. Other Southeast Asian nations, such as Malaysia and Indonesia, have expressed growing concern about the activities of Islamic militants. In mid-November, army chiefs from the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations met in Manila to hammer out a treaty on cross-border arms smuggling and kidnapping. Still, some observers doubt that Asian governments have the will to go after terror groups. Bambang Haryamurti, editor of the Indonesian magazine Tempo, notes that his nation's police force has been unable to arrest Tommy Suharto, the son of the former dictator, wanted on corruption charges. The practice of large-scale hog farming is hampered by the toxic qualities of its end product, manure. Primarily, the phosphorus in manure has the capacity to decimate aquatic ecosystems, leading the Environmental Protection Agency to list concentrated manure as among the greatest threats to our nation's waters and drinking water supplies. In an attempt to deal with the problem at its source, Canadian researchers have created a genetically modified pig whose output contains 60-75% less phosphorus. But environmental groups view the introduction of yet another genetically modified organism into the food chain with great concern. In the words of Laurel Hopwood, who chairs the Sierra Club's Genetic Engineering Committee, "This is just another quick fix. The way to reconcile the problem is to stop factory farming." Additionally, hogs don't actually create the phosphorus as much as they pass along indigestible components of their feed. This influenced the approach taken by a U.S. government researcher who recently developed a breed of corn that lowers phosphorus levels by 50%. Still, farmers seem to find the EnviroPig attractive. Since the animal reduces waste without any modification to the farming structure, it's widely perceived as the cost-effective way to go. Of course, the true cost may not be known for years to come. As an attorney for the National Resource Defense Council's Clear Water Project points out, it's an extreme solution without knowing what the result will be. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Rich Frazier. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Since the September 11th terrorist attacks, the Bush administration has promoted legislation and issued executive orders that have provoked concern among a growing number of civil liberties activists. The USA Patriot Act, which passed Congress with little debate, grants the government new powers to monitor telephone and internet communication and detain immigrants. More than 1,000 non-citizens are now being held by the Justice Department, which has kept the names of those detained secret and refused to specify the charges lodged against these individuals. In the latest round of executive orders issued by the White House, the president allows the government to use secret military tribunals to try non-citizens accused of engaging in terrorist activity. These tribunals will put on trial any person the president dictates can conceal evidence and issue verdicts by a two-thirds majority with no right to appeal to any other court. Other recent executive orders include a Justice Department plan to question thousands of Middle Eastern men who recently arrived in the U.S. and eavesdrop on conversations between some prisoners and their attorneys. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kit Gage, coordinator of the National Coalition to Protect Political Freedom, who explains why she opposes these recent executive orders, which bypass Congress, rejecting the argument that these extraordinary measures are required to effectively fight the war against terrorism.
If you read the executive order, it applies to any non-citizen, could be in the United States or not, who has some connection to a terrorist activity. Now, that connection could be very attenuated, could be very minor, and they may not even know that they're connected to it. But those kinds of folks, even, could be brought before a military tribunal. President Bush is the only one who has the authority to choose who goes before this panel. It's not a judge. It's not a member of Congress. It's the president. He can say, I want Joe Schmo, a non-citizen, to go before this tribunal. Then there is no appeal of that decision. According to the executive order, you can't say I shouldn't have been brought before this tribunal. The tribunal is not a regular court; it is a military court. It is answerable only to the Department of Defense. It's not a court in the same way of being an independent body. It's directly connected to the executive branch. You will remember in criminal trials before a jury, the jury has to be unanimous in bringing forth a judgment. Well, in these tribunals, two-thirds of a vote is all that's necessary to even give the death penalty to somebody. Further, it's quite clear that the purpose of this kind of tribunal is to keep the process quite secret. I'm certain that part of the reason is to be able to use information which would be kept secret from the person and their lawyer. The coalition I work with has a considerable experience with how that kind of process works on the ground, in actual fact, because a number of people that we were working with were in deportation proceedings, and the government used secret evidence against them. You basically have to forget that you're in a court proceeding, because when you don't know the evidence against you, there's no point to it, because you can have the best lawyer in the world, and I think in some of these cases people did. The lawyers can't disprove evidence they can't see. So it's very scary to me to see a military tribunal where only the president can decide who's there, where you can't go even to the Supreme Court to challenge the designation of somebody or the decision of that court. If we allow this kind of proceeding to happen, this is what they call kangaroo courts. This is the kind of court that we see happening in some other country and say, gosh, we're certainly glad we have a constitution in our country, because then we can't have this kind of lack of procedures. This kind of court exemplifies, you know, why we have a constitution.
What about the Bush administration's rationale that we are at war now and extraordinary times demand extraordinary measures, that secrecy cannot be held in civilian courts? Therefore, this one measure, the military tribunal, it's fully necessary for what we're dealing with, the kind of Osama bin Laden terrorists that we're dealing with.
You could certainly argue that that the way that this has been used previously predated the United Nations. The United Nations is set up to deal with these kinds of crises, and it makes perfect sense to look to its procedures to try to deal with something which is clearly an international issue, an international crisis, an international crime of massive proportions. So that's what it's there for, and that's what the proceedings that have been set up, the conventions are set up for.
As we're talking about this military tribunal executive order, is this a fait accompli, or can it be challenged by Congress? How much does public opinion matter here in a president's demand for extraordinary powers?
Well, U.S. public opinion always matters, and what Congress thinks always matters. There's a lot of argument to be made that will certainly be made increasingly in the coming days that this is a congressional responsibility. This is not something which is within the power of the president to issue by his own edict. I know the Congress is holding hearings on this in the coming weeks. I've heard, you know, considerable discomfort raised by a number of people in the Senate and the House on both sides about this. So, I know that there are going to be a lot of questions asked. I know that Mr. Ashcroft will be called forward to clarify what's going on here in this and in other matters. But clearly, the time is now for people around the country, and I've been hearing a lot of these folks, to start talking to their representatives, to start talking to the president and say, you know, it's really important to bring these folks to justice, but it's concomitantly even more crucial not to lose our constitutional rights. We have to be able to recognize this country when we're finished with this process as one which has an intact Bill of Rights. Otherwise, there's, you know, then the right of dissent, the right of different people to practice their different religions and to express their different ideas that we hold dear, that distinguishes us from other places, won't be there anymore.
That was Kit Gage, coordinator of the National Coalition to Protect Political Freedom. For more information on the movement to protect civil liberties, contact the American Civil Liberties Union at area code 212-549-2500 or visit their website at www.aclu.org. In the weeks after the tragedy of September 11th, the misogynist oppression of women under Taliban rule and Islamic fundamentalism was finally noticed by the corporate media, if for nothing else but to garner support for the subsequent U.S. bombing campaign in Afghanistan. Now the Taliban have retreated, and the U.S., in collaboration with the Northern Alliance, has taken over the city of Kabul. But Afghani women have been vocal about the brutality of elements of the Northern Alliance that steered them into the arms of the Taliban 5 years ago. Although there have been assurances of liberalization by those currently in control, where women could now shed the burqa, the full body covering that only allows a 30-degree field of vision, women are still fearful and distrusting, since many have experienced acid being thrown in their faces for being unveiled. On Monday, November 19th, the Access for Afghan Women Act, H.R. 268, was introduced into the House of Representatives by Constance Morella, Republican from Maryland, and Carolyn Maloney, Democrat from New York. The bill urges the White House and the State Department to make the restoration of women's human rights in Afghanistan a priority goal of U.S. policy in the country. Ritu Sharma is the executive director of Women's Edge, a D.C.-based organization working to get the Bush administration to support the bill. She spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about the necessity for women to fully participate in the rebuilding of Afghanistan.
We actually introduced into Congress a piece of legislation. A resolution is merely saying to the president something the Congress would like him to do, but it doesn't require him to do anything. It's just sort of a wish on the part of Congress. What we did on Monday was we introduced a piece of binding legislation called the Access for Afghan Women Act, which would require the president and the State Department to consult with Afghan women's organizations, make sure that they're represented at the table, make sure that all of the tax dollars that are being spent on refugee aid are actually getting to women and their children, and a number of other things to make sure that the president's words are backed up with very specific, very concrete action.
Do you think the United States will support this legislation?
Well, in Congress, we have had overwhelming support for the legislation already, and it's already moving down the chute. It's on a path to pass Congress in the next couple of months. We're working on a Senate version of the bill, and we have had conversations with the State Department about what we're doing, and they can't engage in it directly, of course, but they're not opposing us, and that's what counts.
In the last 5 years, the oppression of women under Taliban rule has been addressed in the independent media and lately by the major corporate media. But there have been some people working fervently for years against the continued oppression of women by the Taliban.
Well, in terms of the U.S. government not focusing on this issue in the past, I think that's really a missed opportunity. And women in these countries in particular are like our early warning system. Countries that oppress women are much more likely to support terrorism. They're much more likely to be extremist governments. And these are not the kind of countries we want in our global community. So that starting now, the United States has a lot to gain by paying attention wherever and whenever women are oppressed. So I think that what we'd like to see happen now is to really focus our energies on restoring the rights of women in Afghanistan and also making sure that these kinds of governments don't come to power in all of the countries that surround Afghanistan. And the problems that we've seen with women's rights in Afghanistan are not only specific to Afghanistan and other countries such as Pakistan. The domestic violence rate there is above 90%. In Uzbekistan, when it was under Soviet control, women and men had equality. Everybody got an education. Everybody could work. And women are rapidly losing those rights as Islamic fundamentalist governments gain power. We are mobilizing every domestic women's organization in this country to alert their membership, alert the general public to this piece of legislation, and asking people to pick up the phone and call their member of Congress, call their senators, even call the White House and say, we need you, we want you to support this Access for Afghan Women Act, and this is the time. This is the most critical time that we have to push for the restoration of women's rights in Afghanistan.
Do you think, Ritu Sharma, that this is actually a viable situation for women, that they actually will participate in a 50% decision-making process in the nation rebuilding process in Afghanistan? Do you think this is possible?
I think it's possible because it's happened before in Afghanistan. And I think that at the very least, we can get women back to where they were in 1990. I think the most important thing is for us in the United States to realize that this world has just become incredibly small. And more than ever, we've got to care about what's happening to people, to women halfway across the world. And this is a golden opportunity to start doing that. But I think we all remember we want the same things. You know, we want to be able to walk in the sunlight without covering our face. We want to be able to send our kids to school. We want to live in safety. We all really want the same things.
That was Ritu Sharma of Women's Edge. For more information, call area code 202-884-8398 or visit the Women's Edge website at www.womensedge.org. Plans for a massive demonstration against the policies of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, scheduled to coincide with the financial institution's annual meeting September 30th in Washington, D.C., were called off when the summit itself was canceled in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks. The growing global social justice movement had expected 50 to 100,000 activists to participate in a series of actions calling attention to economic policies that protesters say exacerbate poverty around the world while enriching wealthy corporations. After canceling their Washington gathering, the World Bank and IMF rescheduled their summit to meet in Ottawa November 17th and 18th. With short notice, activists from Canada and around the hemisphere pulled together a number of demonstrations to greet delegates of the financial institution. But police reacted to the several thousand protesters that came to Ottawa with what many describe as excessive force. Rubber bullets, pepper spray, and water cannons were fired at demonstrators, with many suffering bites from police dogs used for crowd control. In the end, some 50 activists were arrested, with only a few held on serious charges. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and spiritual activist Starhawk. Starhawk, who led nonviolence trainings at the Ottawa Actions, was briefly detained with dozens of others at the U.S.-Canadian border due to her activist past. She reports from Ottawa on how the September 11th terrorist attacks have affected the organizing and agenda of the global social justice movement.
Well, Gandhi did say that, you know, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they attack you, then you win. So by that token, we should be close to winning. I think we're having a tremendous effect, and I think the level of the attacks and the repression comes because we're really hitting at the heart of the beast. You know, we're talking about the basic economic system of global corporate capitalism that is at the core of all of these issues that so many of us are deeply concerned about. And I think that's hitting them where it hurts. They are desperately and sometimes quite ruthlessly trying to defend it. But each time they do, in one sense, they lose a certain amount of legitimacy. If they are saying that these institutions represent democracy all over the world, but they're attacking peaceful protesters with police dogs, there's a disconnect, and that piles up. Also, what we saw in the meetings here at the IMF and the World Bank is that their entire agenda now has been influenced by the protests. You know, they're not actually doing anything, but at least at this point, they realize they have to give lip service to the idea of debt reduction. They were talking about, oh, yes, we have to work together, rich and poor countries, we have to reduce the debts. You know, we'll see if they actually do any of that. But the fact that they're giving that lip service basically means that there's other issues that they're not getting to, and there's other agendas that they're not being able to push forward.
How do you think the September 11th terror attacks has changed the landscape, the climate, here in the United States and around the world for the social justice movement? I'm certain it has provided new challenges to the movement. Many people are diverting their attention to protesting the pursuit of war against terrorism and looking for peaceful solutions to terrorism rather than more violence. Where are the events of September 11th taking the global justice movement, in your opinion?
Well, I think September 11th has made our work much more challenging because, first of all, it's allowed the right wing to just jumpstart a lot of their agenda. I think some of that is wearing off now. And, you know, I think that there are things that we're going to be able to really prevent them from pushing through. But it definitely gave them a good little leap ahead on a lot of different things. It's definitely intensified the climate of repression, and it's made it a lot harder to get public attention. I think, though, that if we respond to these challenges creatively, it's also opened up some tremendous opportunities. Yes. A lot of people are focusing on the war, but I don't see the war as a separate issue to these global justice issues. The whole system of global injustice that creates a climate in which terrorism can flourish. You know, despair breeds terrorism. Despair also breeds the kinds of conditions that breed fundamentalism. You know, when you have this kind of global culture of McDonald's and this sort of soulless shopping mall culture that's being imposed over the entire world, that disrupts traditions, disrupts traditional cultures, completely demoralizes whole cultures. Those are the conditions that breed fundamentalism. People start to go looking for something else, and generally the first answer there is something rigid and clear and authoritarian and clean-cut. So we've got to look at these larger global issues if we want to really deal with the root causes of war. And we've got to look at the way that war and weaponry and American firepower is the ultimate backing for this global system that more and more countries don't want. In some ways, this war in Afghanistan is a way that the U.S. can show every other underdeveloped country in the world that when it comes right down to it, we can blow you into dust.
We are living in some very scary times. We see the right-wing ascendant after the attacks on U.S. soil, the worst attacks in our history, killing some 5,000 people in New York City and Washington. There's a kind of a tribalism here, a sort of a nationalism that has an ugly side to it. In the United States, there's sort of a visceral negative reaction to those calling for peaceful solutions to violence. And I'm wondering, because the global social justice movement, at least large elements of it, have sort of cast their lot with those seeking peaceful solutions, could this, in your view, undermine the potential for a broad, powerful coalition of groups and individuals fighting for social justice in the future?
I don't think that it will in the long run. Again, if we're creative, if we can get out of our sort of leftist little boxes and language and actually talk to people in language that people can understand. The September 11th attacks were horrific, and they left us in a state, in many ways, a state of shock and grief. And that can be a very powerful, open state. You know, I think that there's a way in which the right wing and the media are trying to construct this story for us, that now everybody is behind Bush and everybody is a flag-waving patriot. And it misses the real subtleties and the real nuances of what most people are actually feeling. I think most people are not actually feeling enraged, let's go get the Afghans. I think most people are feeling shocked and scared and confused. I think if we can start to actually speak to people about their real concerns, we have a chance to reach people in ways that maybe we haven't had before. But it requires us to not just do the things we've always done before and say the same things we've always said before.
That was author and activist Star Hawk. Her recent books include The 12 Wild Swans and The Spiral Dance. You can visit her website at www.starhawk.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Rich Fraser, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.